Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did, baby. We started to burn many things we found. That's the fabulous Dora Williams singing to us again from the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns. Glad to have you back here for a fairly somber program. We have a lot to talk about with David Lockbaum, one of my great heroes. Who's been on the nuclear safety case for a long, long time. We won't disclose his formidable age, but he's a wise man and knows more about nuclear safety than just about anybody. David, you with us?
Yes, I am, Harvey. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. It's always an honor. You're with the Union of Concerned Scientists. You have been with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And we had a pretty big shocker come out. It's not often. In fact, I don't think it's ever happened before that you have seven employees, engineers with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, come forward to file a public document warning about a generic safety defect in only 98 of the 99 reactors in the United States. David, can you tell us about this, please? This is a stunner.
Yeah. It dates back to January of 2012 when the Byron nuclear plant in the state of Illinois had a problem where they had what's called an open phase condition. Alternating current power in some places is three phases. You have three wires that transmit the electricity from point A to point B. At Byron, one of those wires broke. But the systems that were supposed to detect a problem with voltage, a problem with your electricity, weren't designed to detect that. The system that they had at Byron and at these other power plants would compare the one phase to a second phase, phase A to phase B, and compare phase B to phase C, but it took two separate indications of a problem for the protective devices to step in and do their thing. In this case, the C phase failed, and the detection system didn't detect it as it was supposed to. As a result, for about 8 minutes, the plant operated with degraded voltage that could have wiped out the motors for emergency pumps needed to cool the reactor core, the spent fuel pool, the containment, and other control room and elsewhere. Fortunately, that didn't happen, but it was more luck than skill. The operators detected the problem after 8 minutes and took the actions that the system that was installed was supposed to do. The NRC looked at that, determined that was pretty high risk. That was about 100 times higher risk of core damage than the typical problem at a nuclear power plant. The NRC didn't want that to happen again, and was investigating ways to make sure that you detected four problems instead of just spending a lot of money for nothing. The five of the engineers worked in the branch, the part of the NRC that investigated this problem, determined who was affected by it and what the fix was. They had sent out a letter to all plants in the country saying, here's what happened at Byron. In 90 days, tell us whether you have the problem or not. The responses came in. Every plant in the country except one said that it did also had the same problem. So the NRC's next step after reviewing, finding, yeah, it's not just Byron, it's basically everybody, was to then order the plants to fix the problem. And the five electric engineers in the branch and two others who supported them were trying to get that to happen. That's when things went awry. They were on a good solution path, but at that point, engineers were finding problems getting the required paperwork through the Office of General Counsel, the NRC's lawyers. There were two pieces of paper that were being prepared. One was an basically an order requiring owners to fix the problem. The second piece was basically an immunity deal where the owners would not, mea culpa, they wouldn't be held accountable for not meeting safety regulations for decades. And if they installed the fix and it, the fix made things worse, they would also be immune from any prosecution. So the order to fix the problem and immunity from past sins and future sins was not going through the lawyers. The NRC kept trying to get it through, get it out, get this problem fixed. They couldn't get it done. They basically lost patience and decided they couldn't. NRC senior management didn't seem like they wanted to solve this safety problem affecting 150 million Americans, so they felt they needed to try a very novel approach, which was to submit a petition as private citizens, not as NRC employees, to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, compelling every plant in the country to fix this problem. So on February 29th, their petition went public. Reuters picked it up. Scott Staff then sent it out, tweeted it around the world. It went viral, Israel, and it is getting the attention that it deserved long after the fact. But those seven NRC engineers who basically put their careers on the line are my heroes because they basically put targets on their back because the NRC doesn't like people who worry about safety. So their careers are at jeopardy, but they did it unselfishly, trying to protect millions of Americans.
Wow, I mean, it's a terrifying story. You speak so plainly and so engineerly, let's put it that way. But tell us, David Lochbaum, of the Union of Concerned Scientists, what could have happened in this 8-minute gap at the Byron nuclear plant in Illinois had things gone differently?
I'll answer that a little bit broadly because the Byron event is not an isolated case. The petition, the seven engineers, documented 13 events, including Byron, in the last 14 years. So this problem happens about once a year. So Byron was not by any means an aberration. There are two possible situations where this event could come into play. One is like Byron, where the circuit that had the problem was energized at the time. Electricity was flowing through that cable to safety equipment at the plant. In those 8 minutes where the power supply was degraded, the plant equipment being fed with that substandard electricity could have failed. An example I'll give is my parents had the power line coming into their home fail one time. An open phase, one of three phases, failed at their home. And at the house level, it's 240 volts. You use most of the half of that, 120 volts, goes to electrical outlets throughout the house and low for appliances, radio alarm clocks, et cetera. You need a whole 240 volts for large appliances like refrigerators, air conditioners, electric ranges, et cetera. With the failure that my parents had, they were only getting 120 volts, nothing on a 240 volt side. The refrigerator motor was getting current electricity, but not enough to run. So it sat there, tried to get more and more electricity to run, burned itself out, could have started a house fire. Fortunately, it didn't, but the refrigerator is gone. Had that been a safety pump at a nuclear power plant or the air conditioning unit, a control room at a nuclear power plant, it could have been destroyed as well by that kind of open phase condition.
The motors then that would have burnt up at Byron or the other nuclear plants would have been, that therefore, had they burned up, would they have compromised the safety systems of the nuke?
Yes. The power condition, you know, had the motors been affected, been burned up, they would, even if power was restored from another place, a more reliable place, like the emergency diesel generators or other backup sources, once the electric motors are damaged, they're out of the game. They're on the bench. They can't play in the safety game anymore. If that situation were to arise, the plant needed to hope for the problem not affecting all safety equipment, just, you know, taking some of the safety pumps off the table. But you run the risk of having that electrical problem or that power supply problem disabling the motors for safety pumps and their backups. Kind of like doing what happened at Fukushima, where the water submerged electrical equipment and disabled primaries and their backups. In this case, the degraded voltage could have the same effect.
Oh, my God. So how seriously do you take this as a safety threat to
sure.
the public?
It is a problem that it's very low probability, even though it happens once a year. That's across the world. That's not just the United States. So, but it does happen. It's a problem that could affect all the primary systems and their backups, so that needs to be addressed. But I don't think it's a problem that means these plants need to be shut down until the fix is installed. But I do think it's a situation where we know what the problem is. We already know what the solution is. The Byron plant has implemented a fix. The owner of that plant has offered to make that fix available to anybody who wants it for free. So it's not like we don't know what the problem is. We don't know what the solution is. We just lack the will to fix it. What the situation that I think the NRC and the industry would hate to find themselves in is if some plant had a disaster, how could they appear before the congressional committee investigating and say,
yeah.
look, I did everything possible to protect the public except install the fix that the company's given away for free. Except for that, I did everything I possibly could to protect millions of Americans. You know, they'd go to nuclear jail. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I don't know. You know, it's 5 years out now. We're just getting the first indictments at Fukushima. There have been apparently three indictments either handed down or about to be handed down. But this is 5 years after the accident at Fukushima. Now, are you saying that in a worst-case scenario, this generic flaw, which is in 98 of 99 reactors in the United States, could cause a major meltdown?
Yeah. I mean, that's the reason the NRC was belaboring to fix the problem, and why it was fixed at Byron was with this problem. If you had by itself, this problem would not lead to a meltdown at one of our reactors. But if this situation occurred at a time when you've taken the emergency diesel generators out of service for maintenance, as plant owners are allowed to do for up to 7 days while the reactor continues operating, and then you have this problem, you've taken away primary power and the backup. So you could be in a station blackout just like Fukushima was, and we know how that script turns out. So this situation reduces your defense in depth or your takes away your safety net and makes you more vulnerable for that kind of bad day.
It's staggering. I mean, it's staggering to hear this. We have...
Yeah, I think that's...
Well, go ahead. You're not staggered. I'm staggered.
Well, I think that's why the seven engineers felt that they could no longer sit on this issue like it was a suppository. They felt the need to put their careers at risk to fix a problem that affects millions. There's like 150 million Americans who live within 50 miles of a U.S. nuclear power plant. 98 out of 99. And by the way, the four new nuclear plants being built in the southeast also had this problem. So the fix that they sought was to also fix it at the plants under construction. We know what the solution is. We have the solution. Shame on us if we don't implement it. I mean, I don't know what the right term is, whether it's murder or manslaughter or criminal negligence, but it's a choice of which bunk in nuclear jail that you want.
Well, how much would it cost on a plant-by-plant basis to fix this problem?
The company that owns Byron offered to give away the fix. They won't go out and buy the hardware and install it for you, but they'll give you the blueprints, the evaluations, and what is needed to fix it. I saw a picture of the fix at Byron. It's a box smaller than a microwave oven that monitors the electricity flow in those three phases and detects a problem. So it's, in a nuclear scale, that's peanuts. It's so little that there's no excuse for it not being installed at all the plants in the country.
Well, do they have an excuse for why they didn't do it?
Yeah, they the owners, again, they want a immunity from having operated their plants for 40 years in violation of federal safety regulations. And they also want immunity from, if they install this fix and they mess it up and don't do what owners, Byron's owners, doing, and they make it worse, they want immunity from future sins as well. And the NRC is working on giving them get-out-of-jail-free cards. And that's why they've not installed it, because they, if many of the owners feel that if they installed the fix now, that'd be an admission of guilt, and they don't want to admit guilt until they get immunity.
Oh, God. I mean, well, first of all, what is the one plant that, where this is not a problem? Is it
I've not nailed that down yet. I think it's the Callaway plant in Missouri that has a different type of electrical breaker that makes it not susceptible to this type of problem. But I haven't finished the homework necessary to confirm that.
But I was going to assume it was, sorry.
I was just saying, you know, the fact that it might be 98 out of 99, that we still need to work on it to make sure all the plants are in that category, not just one lucky one.
I was going to assume it was Watts Bar, since that's new, but I guess that's not the case.
That's not the case. I know it's not that one.
All right.
I wish it was, because that's the one of the ones closest to me, but that's not the one.
Talking about David Rockbaum, one of our leading nuclear experts outside the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, thank God, at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Do you think that the seven NRC guys who came forward are going to be suffer retribution?
I hope not. I sometimes facetiously or not refer to the NRC as the Nielsen Ratings Commission. And I think the public spotlight that's been put on this issue and those seven will make it very difficult for NRC to act. In other issues that are not so public, people have stepped forward. Larry Cresson, who is an NRC engineer who identified problems at a Coney plant in South Carolina, has been investigated three times by the NRC's internal police, found innocent all three times because he didn't do anything wrong other than voice safety concerns. Dr. Michael Peck, who was the NRC's senior resident inspector at Diablo Canyon, raised concerns about earthquake protection there, has been investigated three times, have been found innocent all three times because he's done nothing wrong other than raise safety issues. But that persecution of people for raising safety issues silences a lot of the NRC workers. There was a survey that came out in the last 2 weeks of the NRC workforce, and something like more than 50% of them said they were afraid to raise safety issues for fear of retaliation or discrimination. And when you have a safety regulator, it'd be like cops on the beat who'd be afraid to arrest people for murder or find stuff because for fear of retaliation from their management. That would be unacceptable. But at the NRC, it's same old, same old.
It's terrifying. You mentioned Michael Peck. Michael Peck was the chief inspector at Diablo Canyon in California for 5 years. He wrote and correct me if I'm wrong, David, he wrote an internal report warning that the Diablo Canyon nukes could not withstand an earthquake from one of the 12 or so fault lines around Diablo Canyon. And the report was buried. And then he was buried. He was moved from Diablo to Chattanooga, I believe. Has anything come of that?
Yeah, he wrote the report, the internal report, saying that this plant is not safe by our standards, which is his job. But the NRC apparently doesn't like it when you do that job. So he was investigated twice while I was at Diablo Canyon. Again, found innocent both times because he did nothing wrong. He could see the writing on the wall. They did not like him. They were going to continue to persecute him. In fact, they told him, we have 32 investigators. We'll keep investigating until you find you did something wrong. Used a NRC copier for a copy in your private tax return or something, and we'll get you. It's only a matter of time. So he saw that he didn't want to be in that target anymore, so he applied for the job in Chattanooga that I left when I left the NRC. So he's working in my old job for the NRC in Chattanooga. And they investigated him one more time there just to make sure he and his fellow colleagues got the message of silence is golden when it comes to nuclear safety issues.
God, it's terrifying.
The problem is if you had a Congress who gave a darn about the health and safety of millions of Americans, it'd be wicked easy to call these NRC 7 before a congressional committee and say, excuse me, why did you feel it necessary to go outside of your safety regulator agency to raise a safety concern? Could you explain that? And then bring their bosses in and say, why did you ignore the safety issue? December 28th of last year, one of those seven, the most senior of those seven, sent an email to Bill Dean, who's, you may remember Harold Denton from Three Mile Island. Dean is in the role that Harold Denton had at those times. He's the top guy in charge of reactors in the United States, saying, this is a problem. We're not dragging our feet on the fix. You need to accelerate it, or we're gonna have to do something. He never got a response. So here's a guy internally raising an issue to one of the top senior managers at the NRC, saying, we have a safety problem, gets no response whatsoever. So you gotta go to somebody who might just give a darn. It's apparently this guy was Rhett Butler. He just didn't give a damn, and that's not the kind that we need working for the NRC.
Well, it seems to me the NRC is being run by Scarlett O'Hara, so I don't mean that to be a sexist comment, but,
I thought you meant dead people, not a woman, and I would agree.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, it just gets... this is a cheap fix. You got all the reactors in the country. You're playing with the cooling systems of these nukes. We've already had Fukushima, which had, loss of backup power, was the culprit. And this was in 2012, 4 years ago, and they can't get this fixed?
Apparently not. The NRC has a policy. If an owner submits a request to increase the power level of their reactor or to operate for 20 more years, license renewal, the NRC's program is to resolve those issues in 2 years or less. So I've suggested that they label safety issues nuclear business and also resolve them in 2 years like they do these other things. Because otherwise this stuff gets done in the NRC's spare time and the American public is not getting. The other thing is McDonald's used to have that thing over 40 million served or something like that. The sign out of the NRC ought to say over 150 disserved or something, because they're not getting what they deserve, they being the American public. The NRC is letting half the country down in terms of exposing them to undue risk, and it's just unacceptable.
Well, let's talk about another thing we're hearing a lot about now lately, which is tritium leaks, especially at Indian Point. The governor of New York has really gotten on his high horse about shutting Indian Point. And he can't. It is a statement, a testament to our country that the governor of a state cannot get a nuclear plant shut. But what would you want to say about the tritium leaks that they're finding now at Indian Point?
Well, the NRC has had regulations on its books since early 1970s. That say that a molecule of water that's radioactively contaminated or an air molecule cannot be released to the environment except through monitored and controlled pathways. The leak at Indian Point is not monitored and not controlled. They don't know where it's coming from, but they do know that radioactively contaminated water is getting into the environment. That's against federal regulations. If the NRC were to try regulation for like 30 days and see if they liked it or not, they would enforce those existing federal regulations. And under those regulations, they can impose a fine of $130,000 a day, every day the violation exists for each reactor. There are two reactors at any point. So that's roughly $250,000 a day for as long as it's been going on for a while. If you start writing them tickets, $250,000 a day, I'm betting that the owner would be able to figure out where it's coming from pretty damn quick. But if you give them, if you enable illegal behavior just simply because it's not killing anybody at the moment, that is unacceptable. That's essentially what the NRC is doing. They have regulations on the books. They're choosing not to enforce to allow this owner to continue to operate the plant and make money.
And to endanger all the people of New York, of the New York area. I mean, I assume that if tritium is leaking, there's got to be something wrong with the reactor.
Since I don't know where it's coming from, it's hard to tell that it's not getting into places that it shouldn't be. It is a problem, and that's why they have the regulations. It wasn't developed just because they had some blank space on this page to fill up. It was the regulations were designed to protect the public. But they only do that when they're enforced, and the NRC is not enforcing them. So it's basically luck that's now protecting the people of New York from first harm caused by the tritium, which is radioactive and can cause all kinds of problems. But second of all, when it happened in Illinois at the Braidwood plant, the leakage of radiation dropped the property values because it's hard to buy a house in a neighborhood that's got tritiated water in the community. So people couldn't give away homes around that plant. So now you've got people in Indian Point near in the community who are facing a health risk, not of their own volition, and run the risk of having financial harm. So it'd be nice if the NRC would get off the bench, stop acting like mannequins, and see if they could enforce these safety regulations. If they don't want to, quit. Go right across the street from NRC headquarters is a McDonald's. They could walk across the street, be head French fry boy or whatever, and let somebody who wants to do their job and protect the American public do that job.
Well, that's a radical. So basically you're proposing, David, and I know that you don't want to be branded a communist or anything, but you're proposing that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission actually regulate the industry. Do I understand you properly?
Well, they got a choice. They could do that or drop the R out of the name and just be called Nuclear Commission. But if you're called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you got to regulate at least once every blue moon or something like that. But they don't do that, so they don't deserve that label. They also don't deserve the salaries they're getting to protect Americans from radioactivity because they're not doing that job.
Do you have another particular issue jumping out at you right now in the generic or otherwise that particularly concerns you about our current state of American reactordom?
Well, I think the issue that we'd most like to see fixed, even greater than this open phase issue, is the storage of spent fuel at nuclear power plant sites. I hate to say this because the industry may view this as a challenge, but I don't think we could store spent fuel less safe and less secure than the way we're doing it. Across the United States, approximately 75% of the spent fuel, and that's the fuel that comes out of the reactor after being in there for about 6 years, and it doesn't have enough uranium in it or plutonium in it anymore to make money. So they take it out of the reactor, put it in the spent fuel pools initially. Once the spent fuel pools are filled, then they take the spent fuel out of those pools and put it into dry storage, basically large concrete casks that remain on site. Approximately 75% of the spent fuel is in spent fuel pools. The other 25% is in dry casks. If you look at Fukushima, the concern about the fuel in the spent fuel pools becoming overheated and releasing radioactivity was so great, the Japanese used helicopters to drop water into those pools and then used fire trucks to shoot water in from below to keep water in those pools, because otherwise you could have a huge problem, even larger than the Fukushima disaster. At Fukushima that day and to this day, there were 408 fuel assemblies in dry casks that were initially submerged when the tsunami waters visited the site. The tsunami waters receded, the air cooling picked right back up, and there was in the spent fuel pools, you need electricity to operate pumps to continuously circulate water through the spent fuel pool and remove the heat that's being emitted by the spent fuel. In dry casks, you have less fuel in a dry cask than's in the pool, and you use air cooling to remove the heat that's being emitted by the spent fuel inside. It's low tech. The guidance have workers go out once a month to make sure that squirrels or birds haven't built a nest in the air inlet or air outlet to block the airflow. That's
right.
But on a spent fuel pool, there's any number of things that could go wrong that could cause a really bad problem. But we, in this country, because the federal government can't figure out what to do with spent fuel, we have it in places that it's not safe and it's not very secure. And we're just, it's just an accident waiting to happen.
I consider it an accident in progress, actually. David Lockbaum, of course, I think what the NRC could do is put signs up and ask the birds and the squirrels not to make mess. I think that would be a...
We could try that.
Yeah,
I'd rather put a sign up asking the NRC to do its job and stop acting squirrely.
All right, well, David Lockbaum, it's always an honor to have you on, and it's always terrifying. So but we want to give kudos and our thanks to these seven engineers who stepped forward. I hope that they don't have to go into a witness protection program or something like that. And we hope that, let's pray that this flaw gets fixed and Michael Peck's warnings about Diablo are heeded and that the nuclear fuel gets taken care of, David. So how do people get a hold of you and how can they support your work?
UCS has a website at www.ucsusa.org, which has information on the current issues. We have a neat interactive feature, a map of the United States that shows which plants have spent fuel problems, which plants have fire protection problems, and so on. And it also has contact information if anybody would like to ask a question about the plant in their backyard or call our attention to another safety issue.
That's great. And, you know, I have a personal question. I once had a map of the United States nuclear industry when it was at its peak, and it had 250 or so reactors that were either online, under construction, or proposed. And I lost that map. Does anyone have a complete map of all the reactors that were once proposed and then have gone away?
We're close to that, but I can get you the additional ones. Our map shows the plants that were proposed and the ones that are closed. We also have a list of the plants that were canceled at various stages of construction that brings you up to that 250 that you mentioned. But I don't know of anybody who has that map. I have a list, but not a map.
All right. And is that list available online from your UCS site?
No. The list of everything but the list of canceled sites. I have a list of which are operating, which have had operating but are now permanently closed, and those that are being proposed. That's available, but I don't have the list of those that we wasted, like Shoreham on Long Island, the most expensive electricity never generated. It's not on that list.
All right. Well, we'll have to get a full, complete list one of these days. David Lockbaum of the Union of Concerned Scientists, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be back at you, and we hope that those guys are safe and we get this taken care of. Okay, David? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Harvey. Appreciate it.
All right, buddy. We'll take a break now. I'll hear a little Dana Lyons, and we'll be back with some stolen election material from Richard Charn and Bob Fitrakis.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Home sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains.
All right, we're back, Dana and my buddy Dana Lyons singing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. I do have a wonderful video video of that with my daughter Shoshana dancing in the woods there to that one. And when she was 9 years old, she, of course, being 16, doesn't like to see it anymore. But what can I tell you? Second half of our show, after we were staggered and blown away by the incredible irresponsibility of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, we're going to talk to a truly great expert, one of the great statisticians who follows our electoral process, Richard Charn. who has done a lot of work with us over the years about various electoral problems and is going to talk to us today. We're going to start. I want to go through a few of the other elections, Richard, that you've looked at. But you kind of grabbed my attention, and not enough other people's attention, by looking at the Massachusetts primary between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Tell us what you saw. When was this? This was a few weeks ago, the primary in Massachusetts, which officially Hillary Clinton just barely won. But tell us what you think about this Massachusetts primary, please, Richard Charnock.
Okay, Harvey, it's good to be on.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Let's see. I did the blog post, and I've been updating it ever since. I came across information that from other sources that were posted and from my own investigation, where the numbers coming out of the precincts and were just, any exit polls, basically exit polls, were just impossible. We had a, believe it or not, a preliminary exit poll that was determined by Ted Soros. I came across it on the Election Integrity Group, where what we had was in Massachusetts, we can't say totally unadjusted, but pretty clean exit poll results for 1,297 respondents. Now, this was the what they were showing, what was downloaded or taken a picture of, was the gender demographic, the gender vote. Very simple, male and female. Very easy to calculate the overall vote shares based on just those two components, percentage of males and the females, and the percentage that Hillary had of each and the percentage that Sanders had. So it turns out that as of 8 p.m., on CNN, they showed the gender vote as 52.3 for Sanders, 45.7 for Hillary. Now, that's a pretty big discrepancy. We have 1,297 respondents. So I figured out what the probability was based on the number of respondents. First had to determine the, obviously calculate the margin of error. And for an exit poll, you have to apply a factor, an adjustment, on top of the theoretical margin of error, which is your cluster effect. So what, ultimately what I came out with was a 3.5% margin of error. Given that information, and also given the, let's say, the two-party vote, well, in this case, it was 50.3 to 48.7, but you convert that to a two-party vote, which is very close, then you plug that into a normal distribution, and you come up with the probability. So the probability that, based on the exit poll data, was 97% in favor of Sanders to win. But that's really not the whole story.
Well, let's make clear, really, Richard Charnock, before you jump ahead, let's make clear. Well, hey, let me just make clear. The public outcome was that Hillary Clinton won. So what you're saying is that the probability, based on your statistics, overwhelmingly, is that in real terms, Sanders should have been the rightful winner. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. But, you know, it's more than just the probability. Simple arithmetic proves it. What you had was 1,297 respondents. But then at the end, there were 1,406 respondents total in the exit poll, was matched to the recorded vote, which was 50.3 to 48.7. Okay, so what you had was a gain in the 114 additional respondents. Clinton gained 114. There were 109 additional respondents from the preliminary numbers. Okay, so how could Clinton gain 114 respondents when there are only 109 left in the final 1,406 respondents? So what they did, once again, as the media always does, and I've been talking about this for years, and of course it's well-known fact, they forced the exit poll to match the recorded vote by actually taking away Sanders, or let's put it this way, adding just seven respondents to Sanders and 114 for Clinton. And they took 12 away from the third party. So you have a net of 109. So you have a mathematical impossibility. This is way out, and, you know, it's obvious. It's exactly a replay of what happened in 2004 and in other elections where you had impossible changes. So you could, you know, the probability is one thing. That's a theoretical exercise. But when you have the actual adjustments made to match the recorded vote, that's an indication that there's something very definitely wrong. And what's wrong is the exit pollsters are lying. They're lying about the exit poll. It's as simple as that. And it's a well-known fact. They'll match all the time. So what we've got is a situation where, you know, they had no other choice, because it's standard policy, to adjust the numbers. Even though the adjustments were impossible, they had to do that to match the recorded vote. So that tells me that, you know, as it did in 2004 and in other elections, that it was totally impossible. And there's your proof right there. Okay, there's your proof. And it proves, and what I did in my blog, which was about the primary, which went viral. I've got over 15,000 viewers, and it's every day I'm getting more and more. I try to show a complete breakdown of how mathematically it was impossible. And not only that, I quote the American Association of Public Opinion Research. And let me just read the quote. They're talking about explaining exit polls in this article. Quote, in close races, the projection models also employ actual vote totals, first in sample precincts as it becomes available, and then at the county level for all counties in a state as they become available. It is important to note that after the votes have been counted, the exit poll results are adjusted to match the actual election outcomes. It is in this way the final exit poll data can be used for its primary and most important purpose, to shed light on why the election turned out the way it did. Of course,
go ahead. Sorry.
So this is the AAPOR, which is the Association for Public Opinion Research, prestigious organization, is in effect saying what the exit pollsters themselves admit, that they match the recorded vote. But they don't tell you that the matching process is based on impossible adjustments, mathematical adjustments. And they don't say, of course, AAPOR doesn't want to editorialize, but if you read it and you think a little bit, you realize that there's no rationale for changing the numbers. We do a poll. Let's see what the poll shows us. And if the poll doesn't agree with the recorded vote, well, then there's something wrong. There's something wrong with the recorded vote, or there's something wrong with the poll. But we're not. If all you're going to do is match the poll up to the recorded vote, then why take a poll in the first place? Just say that the poll. Don't even take the poll and say that the poll matched the recorded vote, because it always does. Okay?
So Richard, this is Bob Petrakis. I've been.
Hi, Bob. How you doing, buddy?
Doing well. I've been looking at your work. Just put some of it in the book Harvey and I are working on. But again, could you expand a little on the possibility of an algorithm? I mean, this repeated pattern of the larger the precinct size, the more the deviation from the unadjusted polls, which is now appears to be a pattern that repeats itself. We saw it in 2004 in Miami County in Ohio, and now it seems like a plausible explanation. I saw your brilliant analysis of the 2004 election in this notion of how Bush lost 2.5 million kind of rural Republican voters, but supposedly made it up in urban areas and in the suburbs, which seemed impossible.
Yeah, I was just going to get into that. That's the next section in my blog post here.
Well, let me, Richard, jump in on you for a second and summarize, because we're getting into technical territory here. But we want to make clear that what we're talking about here is the Democratic primary this year in Massachusetts, where they, in a very, very significant outcome, Hillary Clinton allegedly defeated Bernie Sanders. And it has had a major impact on the race. People would not be talking about an inevitability of Hillary Clinton if she had lost the Democratic primary to Bernie Sanders in Massachusetts. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Did I read that Bernie won all the precincts in Massachusetts that had hand-counted ballots and lost all the precincts in Massachusetts that had electronic ballots?
Well,
what
you've got is he won a majority, a large majority of the hand-counted precincts with hand-counted ballots. But he lost where the machines did the counting. So you have he had a 17% margin in the hand-counted ballot precincts. He 57 to 40%. He lost the machine counts by around 50 to 49, or 51 to 49. So that's another red flag, and I'm glad you mentioned it. That we have Harvey. And Bob, we've got multiple confirmations of anomalies. Now, Bob, you mentioned what I call the cumulative vote share trend. I've looked at about at least 7 or 8, 9 governor elections in 2014 where the same pattern occurs. I believe that based on the vote share trend, cumulative, that there are probably, and not only vote share, but even in Massachusetts, which is one of them, and Michigan, by the way, both governor elections were stolen. Okay? They were stolen in Florida. It was stolen in Wisconsin. I don't know. It might have been one or two others. I don't have them right in front of me. But the point is, Bob, your question, let me answer it. The cumulative vote share analysis is really very basic, and it's telling us what we know intuitively. The Democrats do much better in urban areas than they do in rural areas. There's no question about that. All we're doing by doing the cumulative vote share is presenting it graphically. Now, but I go even further than that. I look at the deviations in the cumulative vote shares, they all start off with the Democrat doing well. In the small, pretty flat in the small precincts. In other words, a Democrat would get, let's say he's getting 30-35%, he'll get about the same at the end of the final count. So in other words, the deviation is very minimal in the rural precincts. However, if you go to the top five or 10 counties, I'm talking about counties now, you will find almost uniformly that the Republican is gaining share as the Democrat is losing share. So that's another key smoking gun. Why is it that there's very little deviation in the smaller urban precincts, but large deviation in favor of a Republican in the big urban, suburban counties and precincts in those counties? That, what that means, and I'll just end it with this, is that the Republicans, it's pure common sense, if you want to steal an election, you got to go where the votes are. I mean, this is very basic. So they don't bother with small counties with 3,000 or 4,000 individuals where they already got 75% of the vote. They go where they can get, they got to get the bang for the buck. So they'll go to Milwaukee County, okay, or they'll go to some of the big counties in Florida. Actually, Duval is one that is very anomalous. I find the same pattern in virtually every election. And so what we're seeing now is something different. We've got now Democrat versus Democrat. So I would like at this point to make one statement. There is some research currently going on which shows that Sanders in Michigan did extremely well in the vote machine in the jurisdictions that were vote machine counted. But where there was absentee ballots, the absentee ballots were heavily in favor of Clinton. In other words, let's see very simply, you have approximately Bernie Sanders getting 54% of the machine counts, believe it or not. But he's only getting 25% of the absentee ballots. These numbers will be documented, are in the process of being documented. I didn't come up with this. John Brakey from Arizona did. But that, to me, we've got a different situation. We've got Democrat versus Democrat. Who controls the voting machines? The Republicans. To me, the logical thing to say is that the Republicans didn't do a thing about these the primary. They didn't touch the voting machines on the Democratic side, okay? The Democrats did it to the Democrats, okay? So bottom line, Sanders won by much more than what he is supposed to have won by, which is, 1.5%? He won by, at least in my estimation, he probably won by 6-7%. Okay, I'll
talking with Richard Charvin here, expert on voter analysis, obviously, and Bob Fitrakis, my co-author, on our upcoming book, The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. Bob, you want to ask Richard anything about this? I mean, we would rarely think that Bernie Sanders would be in a position to steal an election where we would generally guess that the Clintons aligned with the Democratic Party machine would be able to do it. Are you willing to say, Richard Charnin, that the Massachusetts primary in this election was stolen in the Democratic primary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll say it about Michigan, too. Well, Michigan wasn't stolen, but it was almost stolen, okay? In other words, fraud takes place. Election fraud takes place in virtually every election. Okay, you can have fraud, and the Democrat could still. Clinton might have won very big in South Carolina or Alabama, but maybe she didn't win as much as they tell you she won by, because you got machines there that you can't count, do a recount on touchscreens. So what I'm saying is, yes, Hillary did not win Massachusetts. I am completely convinced of that. Michigan, Sanders did much better. than he was purported to have done. And then, of course, you have the other anomalies in the caucuses, which I won't even get into. Those are they were so close, the results, but there's so much evidence that have been compiled by people who have taken pictures, and there's so much going on, and this primary system is totally screwed up. Bernie Sanders should be ahead they had 19 primaries so far, or was it 21? He should be ahead in about 12 of the 21 primaries. And only really lost maybe 8 or 9. That's according to my calculation. I have it in my spreadsheet.
Bob, you want to jump in here?
Well, just the story. I was at the 1980 caucuses, and they're easy to manipulate. I was in Detroit. I was backing Ted Kennedy against Jimmy Carter. And the caucus, no one could really tell what was happening. There's this counting, recounting, and there was a guy there from a union. And I asked the guy I was with, you know, we were with the Kennedy, who's going to win? And he says, no problem. And he points to the guy who weighs about 400 pounds and says, it's all in Big Daddy's hands. Kennedy's going to win. And he goes into the back room, and sure enough, nobody understands it, but he comes out and proclaims more delegates for Kennedy.
Well, let me ask you this real quick, Bob and Richard Turnin. From what we know about the critical outcomes in the Iowa and Nevada caucuses, do we believe that Hillary Clinton was the legitimate winner in those two caucuses?
Let me just say, absolutely not. They were very close, but there were a hell of a lot of anomalies that were all in her favor. And I am not, I mean, all I could say is if you go on the Internet where they document the photographically, among other things, that, you know, that there was an obvious effort to fool people by changing the color of their shirts. These Hillary supporters changed the color of their shirts to make it appear they were Bernie supporters, who were actually changed their mind and were going to vote for Hillary. Okay, so they tried all these techniques,
done. We have to continue this next week. Richard and Bob Patrakis, come back next week. We got to talk more about this. Okay? Thank you so much.
Okay, fine with me.
New York. We'll be back next week.
Glad to be on, Harvey. Thanks.
Right.
Thank you.
Bye.